Good morning, dear brethren and sisters. We'll open our memorial service this morning with the singing of hymn number 23. O how love I thy law, it is my study all the day. It makes me wiser than my foes and keeps me in the way. To the first tune. Hymn number 23. Now I'll ask Brother Alan to give us that necessary word of exhortation. Brother Alan.
Good morning, my dear brethren and sisters. I sometimes say to people who are going to visit London, and I've certainly said it to Alison and one or two others I can think of, that if they listen carefully, they might hear someone speaking English. And as someone who commutes daily to London, and I'm sure this applies to some of you as well, I'm very conscious that a large proportion of the people that I rub shoulders with on the train, on the tube and on the buses, and in the office and in the community, do not speak English as their mother tongue. And moreover, there are plenty of other people with whom they can speak in their own tongues. And nor is it languages just in Europe that we are talking about. There are many other parts of the world whose languages are represented in a city like London, and not necessarily just in the city either. Well, over 150 languages are spoken as the first tongue in many of our schools. Sometimes you can feel like a stranger in your own country. Perhaps surprisingly, the multiplicity of languages does not seem to create too many problems. And maybe that's because this phenomenon has been going on for quite some time. So that distinct communities of people from many other countries have developed, services have developed around them, industries, businesses. Employed people are either from those countries or serve their own nationalities, or maybe they are just proficient in many different languages so that they can operate across various boundaries. And we know that young children in particular pick up new languages, such as English, if they've arrived from some other area in the world, remarkably quickly. It seems to me that what is today more of a problem, and it doesn't detract from the point we're trying to make, is the cultural diversity and the challenge of integration. It's quite understandable that people from one particular country or region or culture should tend to stay close together. But these communities bring a whole range of customs, religions, temperaments, and values that don't always sit easily side by side with those traditionally of this country. We don't exactly have tribal divides here, as there are in other places, but you can certainly pick up certain tensions. Our particular country has gone to great lengths to encourage tolerance, equality, and respect. And of course, this is also a principle that's extended into accepting challenges to the very nature of human beings, including the God-ordained difference between male and female. And while such cultural and colourful diversity is certainly evident in a city like London, it's the same story all over the world, to varying degrees. And the more so in so-called developed countries, where it is regarded as the key to success and progress if these things can be managed. Well, the early chapters of Genesis that we are reading at the moment lay down for our benefit an explanation for these characteristics and their origin. It's interesting that the great events that produced such far-reaching consequences as we have today occurred very early on in the history of mankind, and is something that mankind has striven to grapple with, to manage, to deal with, and sometimes to overcome. And where the ideal of unity is too remote, then man tries to develop preeminence over the others, the other tribes, the other cultures, that brings its own set of problems. And we also note that God caused this dividing of nations to happen as a response to the way that mankind was developing its thinking in the wake of the deception of the serpent in the Garden of Eden, the sudden emergence of sin. In our reading so far this year, we have already read about the flood, why it happened, what it meant for the world, as God used the powers at his command to carry out that dramatic cleansing of the earth. And his intention was to disrupt the corrupting influence of man, not for the benefit of man specifically, but rather for the sanctity of his own name. Well, the world today maintains its interest in the physical and the historical aspects of the flood and many other of the events that took place way back in the times of Genesis. But our own interest in the truth is rather more profound than theirs. We're interested in the aspect which the world would dismiss as a myth, and that is the saving of 8 souls in the ark who were people who believed in God and had faith in him. You don't read about that aspect in the various scientific and archaeological investigations about what the ark was like or where it came to rest and what happened to the rest of the world. It was relatively soon after the flood, something like 350 years, just as Noah was nearing the end of his life, that another dramatic intervention occurred. And it happened in order to put the brakes on another milestone of human ambition. We only have the essential details in the scriptures, but someone had the idea that it was important for the promotion of the human race that their name should be celebrated by building a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and lest they should be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the word name, as we have it in Genesis, means a memorial of individuality by implication of honour, authority, and character. As we read the record, perhaps we tend to concentrate on the Tower of Babel and perhaps skip over the fact that it was the city as well as the tower that was important. And there's an important theme that runs all the way through the scriptures on the subject of cities and how they reflect the ambition of mankind. The first mention of a city in the Bible is found in Genesis chapter 4, where we read that Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bare Enoch, and he builded a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son. So the fact that Cain's son was the first city builder, and the fact that he named it after his son, enables us to draw certain conclusions. It's also worth pondering the fact that the family of Cain set out with this objective so soon after man's exclusion from the Garden of Eden. There was no intervening history, no intermediate generations. So it seems that there was an immediate contrast. The city was built by Cain's family, was not a place which was or could be devoted to God. It was an invention of man, in which he could dwell and think that he was safe and protected, where he could gather together those like him and where they could promote their own interests. It seems that the early followers of God did not build cities. It was furthest from their thoughts. They would have preferred to have remained in the garden of God. Well, we know what God did to frustrate those plans at Babel. We read them this morning with Brother Stephen. "Go to," God said, "let us go down and there confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. And it's no coincidence then that the Bible record takes us straight to the story of Abraham. And what a contrast. The last two verses of chapter 11, "Terah took Abraham his son, and Lot the son of Haran his son's son, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees, to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there." Now it may be, from a historical perspective, that the departure of Abram with his family was part of a migration of people and was not unique to Abram's family. But as we know, This was part of the way that God was working in the life of Abraham, and he showed no inclination to return to Ur. Indeed, he was content to comply with the call that he later received from God to depart even further from his father's house to an unknown place. And he went on to spend many years living in a tent in a land in which he was a stranger. He didn't make it his permanent home. He didn't put down roots. Certainly he laid no foundations. He was dismayed when his nephew Lot did decide to go and live in the city, for Abraham knew that his spiritual life would be in great danger in such a place. And his fears were justified when God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, and the smoke of the burning of that city was visible in the distance as Abraham watched, not knowing at that time whether Lot had escaped or not. So in the great plan God was working out, while Babel was thrown into confusion, and while their scheme to avoid being scattered was being miraculously disrupted, God was doing the opposite for his people, his chosen people. He began to draw them aside from the people of this world, to gather them together for his own purpose. And Abraham became, in the fullness of time, the nucleus of the new family, precisely as the inhabitants of the world were being scattered abroad. And as they became more apostate, more wicked, Abraham set out on a path in the opposite direction. Now, brethren and sisters, our knowledge of the truth enables us to follow this analogy as the history of mankind developed, including its spiritual aspect. There's a clear link between Babel and Babylon, that great city that was characterized by the golden head of Nebuchadnezzar and of which he was so proud. And Babylon as a name comes out again in the book of Revelation at the end of the Bible, and there it becomes the name of a massive spiritual apostasy, fabulously wealthy, but spiritually corrupt. And if you've ever taken the trouble to read about the history and development of the Catholic Church, which we think is the fulfillment of that symbology, or if you've had any business dealings with any of the church's commercial activities, then you will appreciate, I think, how powerful, how influential it is, and how far removed from the ethics and values of the truth that we believe in. But let's return to Abraham. It's with him and his descendants that we are more interested. We've seen how Abraham came on the scene at God's instigation to become the nucleus of a new family, just as God scattered the pride and the arrogance of Babel. And two interesting themes emerge. One is the unifying influence of God's truth on the faithful, the unifying influence, in contrast to the scattering and dispersal after Babel, bringing with it a deep appreciation of God's overruling care without the assistance of humanity. And the second is the concept of a city taking on a new meaning. A few verses from the middle reading for today, which we haven't done, but this draws out the first theme, in fact. We see how the righteous are well aware of the folly of the Babel builders and how God will judge them. So in Psalm 14, we have these words: "The fool has said in his heart, 'There is no God.' They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God. They are all gone aside, they are all together become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall abide in thy holy hill? He who walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart. Preserve me, O God, for in thee do I put my trust. The Lord is the portion of mine inheritance and of my cup. Thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures for evermore. Those passages could have been written as a direct commentary on the events at Babel, seen from the perspective of a righteous man like Abraham. And then we come to the second theme, which is a new concept of a city. For good reason, we associate the whole idea of a city with man's greed, corruption and debased behaviour and his ambition. But actually there is another aspect than this. And it's linked to the fact that God's people are also to be gathered together, as God did when he called Abraham and developed his family. And the city, as a concept, features in this fact. It is a gathering together that God will make happen. This idea of a gathering together was one of the features of the story of the ark. In it were gathered together the animals and the children of God. After Babel, the family, the faithful, were gathered together in the family of Abraham, and they continue to be gathered together in faith, if not in flesh. And there are various other passages that have the same theme. In Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 16, for example, we read, "Save us, O God, of our salvation, and gather us together, and deliver us from the heathen." And in the New Testament, looking forwards, Paul wrote to the Ephesians, "In the dispensation of the fullness of times, he might gather together in one all things in Christ, both which are in the heavens and which are on earth, even in him." And that then brings us to the vital role of Jesus Christ, who we're here to remember, and not just to remember in the work that Jesus did and his crucifixion and his suffering, but how he gathered together in his work all the believers in faith. Perhaps we could just turn over to Ephesians chapter 2 to bring this out. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 4. God, who is rich in mercy, for his great love wherewith he loved us, even when we were dead in sins, hath quickened us together with Christ, by grace ye are saved, and hath raised us up together, and made us sit together in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, that in the ages to come he might show the exceeding riches of his grace in his kindness toward us through Jesus Christ. And verse 19. Now therefore, ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth unto an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit. Of Noah and Abraham, those men who witnessed the tide of human pride growing all around them, and who were no doubt acutely aware of their smallness and their vulnerability in their midst, we have this passage in Hebrews chapter 11, and I'm sure we're all familiar with it. But again, I'd like to read it again. It's Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which you should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in a land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which had foundations, whose builder and maker is God. So there is the city which Abraham was looking for, and all of it made possible by the work of Jesus. And so now we pause to reflect on Jesus, the Son of God. He had no interest in the life of the city, except it related to the things which God was interested in too. He saw no future in magnificent buildings or the temple, because they had nothing to do with the true worship of God. When the time came for Jesus to offer the one perfect sacrifice for sin for all the world, he was taken outside the city walls. He was crucified as a criminal, someone who had, or was thought to have, nothing further to contribute to mankind. And it was not many years before Jerusalem itself would be attacked and its people dispersed, because it was not fit to be the city of God's people. But change is coming. A new heavenly Jerusalem is soon to be revealed. It will be a holy city. In the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was there the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. The very opposite to what God did at the time of Babel. And then we have the assurance that comes to us as believers and followers and worshippers of Jesus. Behold, Jesus says, I come quickly. Blessed is he that keepeth the sayings of the prophecy of this book.
For our memorial hymn, brethren and sisters, I've selected hymn number 267. Saviour, we meet in thy dear name and here present our humble plea. Bless us as now we eat and drink in sweet remembrance, Lord, of thee. Hymn number 267. Hymn 267.
Thank you.
We're going to end our meeting with prayer through Brother Philip, and at the same time I've asked Brother Phil to lead us with the prayer for the physical food and refreshments that we take afterwards. So with the closing hymn of hymn number 283, after which Brother Philip will lead us in prayer. We look to thee, O thou who changest not, when weariness of spirit is our lot. Thou art the refuge whither we may flee. O thou who changest not, we look to thee. Hymn number 283.